Checkers. The place was well kept, but nobody got any calls about Roth. I'm Ken Duffy, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this special Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio program. This is our Worldview Wednesday segment sponsored by World Magazine, and I'm going to have two guests on the program today. My first guest will be Dr. Stephen Meyer, and my second guest at the bottom of the hour will be Marvin Olasky, the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. So we'll be speaking with both guests, first Stephen Meyer for the first half an hour of the program, and then we'll go ahead and switch gears a little bit. Both of the guests are connected here, and you'll see how in just a second, but we'll be speaking to both of these men separately today. First of all, I received a press release that came across my desk here just recently, actually across my email, but it said that Meyer's landmark book on ID reaps 2009 honors. It came out of Dallas, and it said that World Magazine has named the scientist Stephen Meyer as its, quote, Daniel of the Year, unquote, for his fearless and groundbreaking work on intelligent design. His Signature in the Cell book is one of the most important scientific books of 2009, according to the Times Literary Supplement and Amazon.com. Meyer shows how new discoveries in DNA point compellingly towards the intelligent designer at the origins of life. And then it goes on to say in this press release that World Magazine's Olasky, Marvin Olasky, pays tribute to the, quote, questioning, discernment, courage, and perseverance that have distinguished Meyer's intellectual journey. And then it says, despite ferocious opposition from the academic establishment, Meyer has emerged as a foe whom leading materialists refuse to debate. In the actual article that came out in the last issue of World Magazine, Marvin Olasky, writing in there, says this: this fall, Meyer came out with a full account of what science has learned in recent decades, Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, published by Harper One in 2009, shows that the cell is incredibly complex and that the code that directs its functions wonderfully designed. His argument undercuts macroevolution, the theory that one kind of animal, over time, evolves into a very different kind. Meyer thus garners media scorn for raining on its huge, or on this year's huge celebration of the birth of Charles Darwin 200 years ago, and on the publication of On the Origin of Species 150 years ago. So there's just a couple of quotes about what has taken place here just recently with awarding this 2009 Daniel of the Year Award. So with that, let me go ahead and welcome our special guest into the program today. It's Dr. Stephen Meyer. Dr. Meyer, let me first of all welcome you onto the program and also congratulate you on winning this award.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Dr. Meyer, we spoke at one time about the Signature in the Cell when it had first come out, and obviously didn't get through the entire book on the program. It's quite a study here. You know, it would take a lot longer than we could possibly go through on the program at that time. But I wanted to specifically talk with you today about winning this award and some of the ways that Marvin Olasky, in mentioning that you won this award, couched or used the terminology to couch, you know, why you had been selected to receive this. The first thing I wanted to ask you about was that the award, and Marvin, in his verbiage here, mentions the idea of courage, that this honors courage. Explain to our listeners why it would take courage in order to just simply report upon what you find as you look deep into the cells.
Well, I don't know. I feel a little uncomfortable with, explaining what he would have seen in me that would have been worthy of this. I have a great deal of respect for Marvin and what he's accomplished with World Magazine and in his career advising speakers of the House and presidents and so forth. But the one thing I would say is that there is a great climate of fear surrounding this issue. For many, many years now, I would say going back at least to the early 80s, the evidence has been stacking up against the creative power of the natural selection mutation mechanism, and also stacking up against the theory of the what's called the chemical evolutionary origin of the first life, which is what my book challenged. Many people don't know it, but Darwin never even attempted to explain how the first life arose. He only tried to explain how you could get new forms of life from simpler pre-existing forms. Mm-hmm. He didn't have an explanation for how you got from inanimate chemicals to the first life, and in the 150 years since the publication of The Origin of Species, no one else has been able to provide an explanation for that either. But there's been this kind of almost code of silence where people in the evolutionary biology community have papered over really significant problems with the overall evolutionary story of the origin of the first life and the origin of subsequent life forms after that. And many of the scientists in our movement have, I feel quite honored to work with them, because there's a great sense that they're willing to say, hey, the emperor has no clothes, and report the data honestly, knowing that very oftentimes it's going to cost them in their careers. The Ben Stein movie, Expelled, documented a number of those cases with Richard Sternberg at the Smithsonian, Guillermo Gonzalez at Iowa State, Bob Marks at Baylor. So in some ways, I'm just benefiting from the courageous stand that many of my colleagues have taken.
I was going to mention that same DVD that came out, Ben Stein's Expelled. We did have, I think it was some of the producers of that were on the program with us, and we talked about, you know, the animosity that there is and the marginalization that takes place for anybody who simply just tries to look at the data honestly. I find it interesting in this article that was written about you as the 2009 Daniel of the Year recipient. It mentions even David Berlinski in here, who, of course, doesn't make any claims to be a Christian. He says outright he is not a Christian. He's not a believer. And yet he's a non-Christian ally, basically saying that, he's just calling upon his fellow workers.
His good sense as a scientist to understand that this old theory from the 19th century isn't getting the job done anymore. And I think that's, he's... what I'd like to say is I am a Christian myself, but what I like to say is that you don't have to... Not everyone is who advocates the theory of intelligent design or has sympathies towards it. Is necessarily a Christian, for the simple reason that you don't have to be a Christian to see the compelling evidence.
Sure.
What we're talking about in DNA is digital code. We're talking about something which Bill Gates has likened to a software program, and we know from experience that programs always come from programmers, and we know more generally that information in whatever form, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription or a headline in a book or a section of text in a headline in a newspaper, a section of text in a book, information always comes from an intelligent source, from a mind, not a material process. So the discovery of information running the show in DNA and in the cell is compelling evidence of a prior designing intelligence. That's not something that's based on a religious text or a religious dogma, but it certainly does have, I think, theistic-friendly implications. If there is a designing intelligence, the next thing you want to know is who is the designer, and I personally think the most likely candidate for that designation as God himself.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And I love the way that you do that throughout your book, you know, basically just looking at the evidence first. Let's just be honest and look at this and see what where the evidence takes us. But it seems like they say, well, as Carl Sagan said in the opening of his Cosmos, that we're willing to go wherever the evidence points. But if the evidence seems to point to God, they don't seem to be willing to go there.
Well, Sagan is a great example of that because he starts out that famous Cosmos series from the 80s saying the universe is all there is and all there was and all there ever will be. He starts with a presupposition that materialism is true, that nothing besides the physical universe exists. And then when he's confronted with evidence and when other scientists who have the same presupposition are confronted with evidence of a designing mind that is prior to all that matter or shaped that matter, they simply refuse to look at the evidence.
Mm. In the article that we're looking at here, you make some predictions about the longevity of Darwinism being the prevailing theory that people are working with. Do you think that now that we can look within the cell to the level that you're looking at it and writing about it, that this is going to spell the demise of Darwinism as we've known it over the years?
Well, I think it's already happening. There is still a circle the wagons mentality in a lot of the evolutionary biology community. They understand, the bright evolutionary biologists know that the theory isn't working. There's a group right now called the Altenburg 16 of leading evolutionary biologists who simply said it's time to get a new theory of evolution. Darwin's theory doesn't work. Natural selection doesn't have the power that's been attributed to it. But when the issue comes up in public, especially in controversies over what to teach in schools and things like that, you have groups like the National Center for Science Education who play the Circle of the Wagons game, and they will announce publicly, there are no problems, there are no weaknesses in evolutionary theory, and that just isn't credible any longer. So I do think that the theory's in trouble, but I also don't underestimate the power of an entrenched consensus or an entrenched establishment to impose a kind of artificial consensus on the discipline. So I think it's shaping up to be a classic battle of power versus truth, the evidence versus a phony but very powerful consensus.
Mm. Are you able to explain to us in layman's terms the evidence that you found for intelligent design within the cell? Is it the complexity itself?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's as you mentioned, it's a thick book, but the basic argument is very, very straightforward, very commonsensical, and I think for that reason very powerful. In 1953, Watson and Crick discovered the double helix structure of the DNA molecule. 4 years later, Francis Crick realized that along the spine of the DNA molecule, there are four chemicals that function just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code. And if you think about that, that's an extraordinary discovery because, as I mentioned, the DNA is actually functioning like a written language or like a section of software text. What we know from experience is that whenever we find information in a digital or alphabetic form and we trace it back to its source, we always find an intelligence, a designing mind, not just a material process. So the discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA point decisively back to an intelligent designer. But beyond that, since the 1950s and 60s and 70s, a period that we now refer to as the molecular biological revolution, we've learned that inside the cell there's a complex information processing system and that the cell is processing information much like a modern digital computer. There are design strategies. There's a design logic for error correction. There's a design strategy for the storing of information. The cell actually uses a hierarchical filing system, much like the one used on a modern computer. There is a nested coding of information. There's messages encoded within messages, as we would do in a modern cryptographic system where we're trying to conceal an encoded message. So you have all these hallmarks of intelligent activity in the way the cell not only stores but also processes and organizes information, and that's what the book's about. So I have a colleague who's a computer programmer who retired for time from Microsoft to come and work with us to write a simulation of how the cell expresses the information in DNA, how it uses that information to direct the construction of proteins. Mm-hmm. And he came into my office one day and he said, I get an eerie feeling that someone figured this out before us. And then he pointed to all these design, they're called in computer science design patterns. Mm-hmm. The design logic that the cell is using, he said, clearly indicates an intelligent programmer. In fact, he said the cell is using all the same strategies that we use, except it's executing those strategies with an 8.0, 9.0, 10.0 efficiency. And he lapsed into Microsoft talk there, you know?
Yeah, right. You're right there in Seattle, so it shouldn't be too hard for you to get one of those Microsoft.
It's worse than that. It's Redmond, you know?
Oh,
they're just around the corner.
So they just walk over to the office. I wanted to let our listeners know, before I ask you two final questions here, one, I wanted to let them know that they can go out to the website for this book and see some of what you're talking about. There are some graphical presentations of this out on this website. That website is www.signatureinthecell. That's all one word, signatureinthecell.com. And so you can go out there and you can see some of what Dr. Meyer was just describing, some of this DNA in graphical form, the way that he was talking about it, creating code and those types of things. So you can see it out at that website. Second thing, I wanted to let our listeners know that I do have a couple copies of his book here, Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, with me in the studio. I'd be happy to give you a copy. I don't have the ability to mail them to you today, so the folks that are listening via Sermon Audio outside the Greenville area, I just can't make it available to you today, but folks within the Greenville area that are listening via the airwaves, you're certainly welcome. I'd put a copy of this book up at the front desk here at WLFJ Christian Talk 660 Studios, and you can come by and pick one up if you'd like. Let me give you the number if you want to ask a question or make a comment about this book, and then we still have a couple more questions for our special guest today, Dr. Stephen Meyer. The number to call is 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. You can also send me an email at kevin@knowingthetruth.org. That's kevin@knowingthetruth.org, and also Twitter is up and running at Knowing the Truth, any of those ways. Dr. Meyer, before we have to let you go at the bottom of the hour, I wanted you to just answer briefly, if you could, two of the critics that have criticized your work. The first one is, how would you answer Christian critics who say that intelligent design isn't really science? How would you answer that question?
Well, I think it'd be, if for those who have that concern, I think I would really recommend that they read the book. One of the things I do in the book is I show that I tell my own personal intellectual journey and how I first encountered some scientists in the early 80s who were beginning to realize that the information in DNA was the big impediment to solving the problem of the origin of life. And some of those scientists had the intuition that that information pointed to an intelligence. And I left for grad school a year later, going to England, with a burning question. Could that intuition that there's a connection between information and intelligence be developed into a rigorous scientific argument? And I began to study the works of Charles Darwin, because he had developed a rigorous method for studying events in the remote past. And he had a rule of reasoning, a scientific rule of reasoning, which was that if you're going to explain an event in the remote past, you should be looking for a cause which is known to have the capacity to produce the event you're trying to explain. Very common sense rule of reasoning. But I soon realized, as I studied that there was this in more depth, that there was only one known cause that was capable of producing information, especially in a digital or alphabetic form, and that cause was intelligence. Mm-hmm. So by applying Darwin's own rule of reasoning and his method of reasoning, which has a name called inference to the best explanation, I came to the conclusion that intelligent design was the best explanation, for the simple reason that only intelligence is capable of producing the kind of information we find inside life. So if my argument for intelligent design is unscientific, then you would have to conclude that Darwin's argument is as well. Mm. But instead, I would say both arguments are scientific. Both are using an established scientific method. But my argument is based upon evidence that Darwin didn't know about, and that's the difference.
Mm. And that's why so much of this has come to light these days. Just the technology itself, being able to see down that deep into the cell, has exposed things that Darwin never even dreamed about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Correct?
Yeah.
Rather than ask my second question, let me go to the phone lines very quickly. We've got under 5 minutes or so before the break and see what's on Ron's mind today. Ron, welcome into the program today.
Howdy. I'm not too much into this whole concept that you're talking about, but I do hear people say things, and one of the things is, you know, like Richard Dawkins seems to think it's possible that aliens did something, so they would be the intelligent designer. How do you draw from Scripture support of the true and living God?
That there was what he called a signature of intelligence inside life, and he then posited that, well, maybe that could be explained by some other creature that had evolved in outer space. But I don't think that's a very persuasive design hypothesis, for the simple reason that if you can't get life going on Earth, and the problem there is that you can't identify a chemical process that will produce information, then pushing the problem out into space doesn't help. Besides which, there's evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe in what's called the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry. It shows that the universe itself, the very fabric of the universe, is designed, and that's clearly not something that could be designed by any creature within the universe. That points to a transcendent designer, which I think comports with the biblical idea that God is responsible for bringing the universe itself into existence. So I favor the theistic design hypothesis, a.k.a. God.
Yeah, that was a shocking moment in that film, and I think a lot of people would still be surprised to learn that Richard Dawkins actually believes that the data does point to a designer, only he says the designer can't be God, it has to be come from somewhere else, and it's just aliens must have came here. I think if people just heard that, if they just heard that, you know, they would never be out buying his books in the groves that they are. They would just realize, boy, this is really...
Well, you see what's underlying that, Kevin, is this inviolable premise, presupposition in favor of atheism. And in the last few days, you asked at the beginning of the hour about just the ferocity of the debate. And
yes.
In the last few days, there's been I've experienced a little of that, in that there's been this concerted campaign on the Internet to drive down the ratings of my book on the Amazon. And an atheist website, Panda's Thumb, put out an all-points bulletin, you know, calling for negative reviews of the book. And as people have read these reviews as they're piling up, it's clear that people haven't even read the book. Mm-hmm. And but this is the kind of commitment people have. There's a zeal for the atheist dogma that is really driving the opposition to the scientific case that we're making for intelligent design.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And once again, congratulations on winning the 2009 World Magazine Daniel of the Year Award. Certainly well-deserving in my view. I think you've done an excellent job here of putting this together in this book. It's extremely thorough, and I don't think anybody could come away from reading this book and then say, you know, that there is no designer, or that the designer has come from out of space. I think it's pretty evident what has taken place. So thank you again, sir, for your work. Thank you for standing up for the truth, and thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Kevin, and thanks for a good caller, too. Appreciate it.
Okay. We appreciate it. That was Dr. Stephen Meyer. Of course, he's with the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He's actually the director, I think, there for the Center of Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And also, as I was just mentioning, you can read about the award that he has just won in two ways. One, you can look out at the latest issue of World Magazine. And by the way, if you're not getting World Magazine, I highly recommend that you do. You can get four issues of it for only $5 was one of the specials that they were running at this time. So you can go out to their website at www.worldmag.com. That's www.worldmag.com. And the December 19th edition of the World Magazine has the 2009 Daniel of the Year recipient, Dr. Stephen Meyer, on the cover. And then Marvin Olasky writes an article about that award and about Dr. Stephen Meyer in the book, in the magazine. So you can read that article. Also, the publisher and the folks promoting the book for Dr. Stephen Meyer have also sent me a PDF of that article as it appears in World Magazine. I loaded that PDF out on our eDocs segment or section of the www.sermonaudio.com/knowingthetruth website. So if you go out there on Sermon Audio and click on the segment or the portion of the page there, the button that says eDocs, you can go out there and you can actually download a PDF that has that article in there as well. When we come back from the break, we're going to switch gears just slightly, really, because we're going to talk to the one who wrote that article about Dr. Stephen Meyer. We're going to talk to the editor-in-chief of World Magazine, none other than Marvin Olasky. We're going to be talking with him about the tragedy of American compassion. This is a time when many people are giving, but could we actually be hurting by trying to help through our giving? We'll talk about that in a minute.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Looking for the perfect Christmas gift this year? Why not give a gift with a message of hope that has eternal significance? Divine Direction is an audio CD with over 300 Bible verses arranged by subject. It was developed to help people find biblical solutions for everyday issues like anger, depression, worry, and more. Divine Direction gives people hope as they learn that God's Word has solutions for all of life's problems. The biblical model for true change is also explained in order to help us have genuine and lasting victory over sinful habits. Divine Direction also includes a section that explains the salvation message and is an excellent tool for witnessing to unsaved loved ones. Let's face it, people are busy. Divine Direction is the perfect way for those who are on the go to learn God's Word and be encouraged with the message of hope. It's available on CD and also as a download for your iPod or computer. To order Divine Direction, simply go to power-ministries.com. That's power-ministries.com.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
The busyness of the Christmas season can distract us from reflecting on its deeper meaning. Nancy Guthrie has put together a helpful collection of Advent readings called Come, Thou Long Expected Jesus. Published by Crossway, this anthology draws from Charles Spurgeon, Martin Luther, John Piper, Randy Alcorn, and many others. Each essay looks at Scripture and expounds on a particular aspect of the Christmas story. This refreshing collection is perfect for gifts or family devotions.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into the second segment of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. We just finished a segment here with the 2009 Daniel of the Year Award winner that's put out by World Magazine. And with me now on the phone is the person who wrote that article in World Magazine, this Marvin Olasky, who is the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. Marvin, welcome into the program today.
Well, thanks very much. I suspect that Steve Meyer... was a great interview.
Oh, he was. I've had him on before talking a little bit more in depth about the book itself. Today I wanted to ask him a little bit more about winning the award, and I wanted to give you an opportunity here before we switch gears and talk about your book, if you wanted to just comment at all about World Magazine selecting him as the 2009 Daniel of the Year recipient.
Well, the whole question of intelligent design or
just Mac revolution by time and chance is the a key and maybe the key battle right now. So, you know, we were pleased to be able to write about Steve and let more people know about his work. And, you know, over the years, we've had a real variety of folks, ranging from missionaries to the Islamic world, to leaders of crisis pregnancy centers, artists, you know, some of the, I mean, our first one, this goes way back to 1998, was Ken Starr. Mm-hmm. At a time he was involved in the battle with Bill Clinton and just trying to proclaim some biblical understanding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had people from a lot of countries, but always there have been people with guts who weren't afraid to go against conventional wisdom, political correctness, and all that. And, you know, as I suspect you just heard, Steve Myers shows a lot of that.
Sure, exactly. I was mentioning to him the word that has come up in a couple of resources, the press release that I was looking at, some of your comments in the World Magazine, the December 19th edition, and other places as well, was the word courage.
Yeah.
And I think that people should need to understand that the reason why courage is mentioned there is, you know, these folks take an awful lot of flack from their peers, from people that come from a different worldview altogether. And so because of that, when they come out with this type of information, they take quite a beating from the peer reviews and these types of things, and as we saw in the movie Expelled as well. So
right. Yeah, the scientific world is not a world of neutrality and perfect logic and all that. It has its politics like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is a particular, you could almost call it a regime in place now that accepts Darwinian notions and refuses to look at other things even when the facts would seem to demand it.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing a similar thing take place just before our very eyes here with climate change as well.
Sure.
And of course, World Magazine's been writing about that, and I've had a couple of your correspondents on speaking about that subject. Marvin, I wanted to talk with you today. We won't be able to do the impossible here and go through your entire book about the tragedy of American compassion, but I was wondering if you could give us a little compend of it today, a little summary of what people would find in here. And particularly, I'm interested in this subject because, you know, here we are at the time of giving, you know, around the Christmas season. Here, you know, Americans, there's been some reports that have come out just recently just how much Americans actually give to charities. And certainly those are good things. But if I understand your book correctly, that there's a way that we can do compassion. There's a way that we do charity, maybe even especially within the church, that could actually end up being harmful, that could actually, you know, cause a dependency, an improper dependency, and not really help the folks that we're seeking to help. Would you summarize your book for us?
Yeah, I think that's actually a good summary. It's a book of history that shows how in the 18th, 19th, early 20th century, we actually fought poverty very successfully in the United States. And the emphasis was on challenge and personal involvement, rather than just giving people stuff and in a way treating them like animals. I mean, back home in Texas, I had two dogs, and they'd get up in the morning. I'd put some food and water in their bowl, scratch them on the stomach, and mm-hmm. They weren't working dogs or anything like that, so they could just pretty much lie around all day,
mm-hmm.
occasionally go for walks, and I enjoyed them as pets. And sometimes we, you know, people who are affluent turn poor people into pets, basically. You know, wanting to be very kind, put some food in their bowls and so forth, but they're not pets. They're not animals. They are human beings created in God's image and thus capable of doing great things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do that, if you assume that all they can do is be takers and not givers, you are demeaning them and demeaning the image of God in them.
Mm-hmm. A very simple scripture verse that comes to my mind, it says, if a man doesn't work, then a man doesn't eat. So obviously, if you have a able body, a person capable of working, and he refuses to work, and you rush in and meet that need of providing a meal for him, you have actually removed the God-given incentive that he has has, i.e. a empty stomach, you're removing that incentive or motivation that he has to go out and get a job. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's not cruel to refrain from giving in some circumstances when giving will actually hurt.
Mm-hmm.
This works in domestic poverty fighting. I mean, just recently a whole bunch of books have come about international poverty fighting. It's pretty much the same. In fact, there's one book with the title, When Helping Hurts.
Right.
And that's very important. If you infantilize people, if you turn them into dependent individuals, then you're not helping them at all. Our predecessors in the United States, when they thought about poverty, they talked about a poor man being on a ladder. He could either go up towards independence and financial self-sufficiency, or he could go down into total dependence and just begging mm-hmm. on the streets. It's not that the person is at the bottom; he's in the middle of the ladder, and you can hurt a person by just giving money on the streets. My tenancy in New York City, where I live now, is I will give people on the street corners a dollar, but it's wrapped around a card from the Bowery Mission.
Mm.
And my goal is to at least attract their attention so that they will, I hope, avail themselves of services that will really help them to get off the streets rather than just enable them to stay on. So, you know, there have been other times where I just haven't given anything.
Mm-hmm.
But insofar as I have a certain message that I want them to pay attention to, then I do that with a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly would not just be like a Lady Bountiful and pass out dollars or $10 just for the sense of feeling better, a warm, fuzzy feeling that I have that may actually be destroying another human being.
Mm. I've had a couple of those cases myself. I remember not that long ago a person asking me for money to buy a meal, and rather than giving the money, I was willing to provide the meal. And
yeah.
It was interesting how quickly they decided that that wasn't what they actually wanted, you know, that that wasn't going to work in that sense. The second one is that, you know, the car that I drive around has a logo imprinted on it from the radio station, so I'm kind of an easy mark.
Right.
And when I stop for gas or something like that, people immediately see the car, and they know that it's some sort of a Christian ministry. And so I've had them come up and say, you know, can you buy my gas for me or whatever? I'm trying to get to work. And I just tell them outright, you know, I have no idea who you are. I have no contact. I don't know what you're going to use the money for. I don't know what your situation is. And in light of that, I'm willing to give you my card, and I'm willing to get together with you and try to find out what the real issue is. But I can't just blindly just hand out the money because I could actually be doing hurt. Now, a lot of Christians say, well, I've assumed the way to handle this is I just give the money and I let God sort it out in the end. But I think that we're shunning our responsibility when we do that. What do you think?
Well, we are. And especially since there are studies showing that the majority of money just given to homeless panhandlers goes to drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to get them to get some help at places that can help them. There are Christian missions in every major city that can offer real help, and our goal should be to get them there. And you know, the Matthew 25 verse, which is often cited, is a wonderful verse. You know, as much as you did to the least of these, you did to me.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw, you know, people hungry, thirsty, naked, and so forth, did you feed water, give drink to, clothe them, and so forth?
Right.
That's a very wonderful verse. It cuts both ways. If you give a person money that is likely to be used for drugs or alcohol, it's like you're pumping heroin into Jesus' veins.
Mm.
So you can help, you can hurt. And then the same thing writ large is it defines a lot of national policy. The welfare system is good if it gives people incentives and challenge to improve their skills, get a job, get out of poverty. It's bad if it just enables them to stay in poverty and, in fact, pass on attitudes of dependency to their children and grandchildren, and that's the way a lot of it has worked. We've had this intergenerational welfare dependency that's developed out of good intentions, but here's where the tragedy comes in. People mean well, but if you give without thinking, if you give just to satisfy yourself and not to think of what it does to someone else, then you can actually be hurting on a personal basis or on a national basis.
Now, your research that you provide in this book, and let me tell our listeners here today, I do have copies of this book to give away as well. This is The Tragedy of American Compassion by Marvin Olasky, our special guest on the program today. It's put out by Crossway. That's www.crossway.org. And I do have copies to give away if folks want to call in and ask a question or comment. 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. But Marvin, in this book, if I understand it right, the research that you did, and there's a tremendous amount of research in here about how America used to do compassion, the research was showing that there must be tied somehow to accountability.
Right.
That it must be, you know, more personal than just writing a check and putting it in the mail and we don't even know what happens to it. Somehow we've got to be personally involved in helping that person to change their life and get back on their feet. Is that the basic premise?
Yeah, what makes a difference is the spiritual challenge that people have. Again, there are lots of poor people like lots of rich people, I mean, who desperately need Christ, and that's what's going to change their lives. That people need that, and the way people often get that is through personal help. And then people who are poor often need other types of personal help. You know, there are folks who they are one car breakdown or one problem, one child sickness away from losing jobs, let's say, mm-hmm. or not being able to earn a living. And sometimes they need help with child care, with, you know, particular emergencies that occur. And the only way you know whether it's an emergency or whether someone is just making something up to get some money from you is if you get involved in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. I remember a case ours many years ago, but the person appeared to need help, and people, you know, a lot of Christians, frankly, are just bleeding heart Christians, and they want to get in there and help. They want to just throw money at the problem, and they would even sometimes be critical and say, "Why aren't we throwing money at the problem? This person seems to need help." Well, it turned out that this particular person had a large quantity of animals, and dogs was one thing that we found out, and basically I was having difficulty taking the money from the church and then buying dog food with it, you know, when somebody was in real need of it. And secondly, I found out that there was a family member who was very well-to-do, who was traveling around the world and you know, just seemed to have a lot of discretionary income from the vacations that they were taking, and so they were doing little or nothing to help, maybe because they knew the situation better. But here the church, thinking that, hey, we need to rush in there and start paying the bills for this person or somebody, something like that. You know, I think that this is just the way that we do it in our modern age, and they think that checking into some sort of accountability is somehow cruel.
Right. When poverty fighting worked much better than in recent years, the helpers put a lot of emphasis on affiliation and bonding. Affiliation in terms of, they would always ask a person, well, tell me about your family, tell me about, you know, where you used to work, maybe where you went to church, what organizations you were part of. And the goal was to try to reconnect these individuals with the family members or associates who they had once been close to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of homeless people, I mean, there are some who are in dire straits and they don't have anyone to turn to.
Right.
I mean, there are others who have homes, but they don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been all sorts of, you know, family battles and divorces or separations and lots of other things that have gone on. And you're doing that person a disservice if you don't push a little bit to try to reconnect him with people who, you know, who have been close to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are Christian organizations that they really work at that and will provide transportation to allow a person to reunite with family members and so forth. I mean, that type of thing is important. When there isn't anyone involved, then the key thing is to develop a bond with that person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today when we have our modern social workers, you know, some of them would kill for client loads of 1 to 100. You know, they have several hundred usually.
Wow.
There's no way you can have a personal connection when you have that many people. The folks on welfare just become numbers. But you can't afford, as a country, you can't afford to have, let's say, one social worker for every two individuals in need. We used to have one volunteer for every two individuals in need. And these people really came forward. But now we tend to say, hey, you know, I gave to the office, I've paid my taxes, I've done my job. Why do I have to get personally involved? And, you know, that's a reasonable statement to make. It'd be much better if we didn't pay so much in taxes, and sometimes people weren't working second jobs or this or that, and instead had more time to be ministering to people they know and then others to whom they could be of great help.
Mm. That ratio that you point out there, I think, is not only startling when we think about it in this area about social workers and meeting people in financial need, these types of things, but I would make a case that it's not a healthy percentage in the church as well, where a lot of times we don't have the time. The goal is to build up the church with the most number of people and these types of things, but we don't have the time, like a Richard Baxter or something, to invest into the life of the people to make sure that people within our congregations don't end up in situations like this, through counseling them, confronting them lovingly with the scriptures, helping them to apply the word of God to a number of different areas in their life. I think that's vitally important.
Yeah, I've encountered some churches and Christian groups that used to pride themselves in their big numbers, you know, so many thousand fed. And that may be very useful. On the other hand, you know, I've encountered churches and Christian groups that said, well, same people keep coming back again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we doing them any good by just maintaining them in this situation of misery?
Mm-hmm.
So some of these groups have actually changed their programs. Instead of being the mile wide and an inch deep, they've actually decided to have lower numbers but work more intensively,
mm-hmm,
with the people they work with, and they've seen huge accomplishments,
mm-hmm,
with people coming out of poverty, building families, building businesses, becoming financially independent, and not just having the same people come back year after year and figure, well, I'm doing a good job because I'm feeding them.
Mm-hmm. You make the case in the book or tell the story about a man who had gone to a number of different shelters, and he had, maybe it was you, maybe even in your when you asked for a Bible, where you dressed up as a homeless person and then went to certain places and asked for a Bible. But I was going to ask you, you know, this. There seems to be a trend in evangelicalism today where some people are developing, you know, have developmental programs that you were just describing. Some churches are getting into that. But others seem to just be talking about social justice and these types of terms, which sometimes are just basically feeding people and housing and these types of issues. And they seem to be actually getting away from the idea that applying the gospel and, helping people to think through the gospel and giving them the gospel as part of our mercy ministry. Do you see both of those things?
Oh, absolutely. The battle over defining social justice is now joined, in that the Heritage Foundation, for example, in Washington, D.C., has a new website. I think it's called Seek Social Justice, and has just put out some videos trying to explain, with a biblical base, how really to help the poor.
Mm.
So, the word social justice has been used for just economic redistribution. And you look at the Bible and you look at the way justice is used in the Bible. I mean, that's not the way it's used. Justice is very important in terms of relations, people acting decently towards each other, and the way God acts relates in his righteousness to us. Justice is very closely tied, and the biblical term justice, the Hebrew word mishpat, is very closely tied to tzedek, which means righteousness. So that if you proceed in a biblical way, to help your fellow man in a way that really helps, then you are indeed pursuing social justice. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that social justice is the same thing as any kind of a forced redistribution from rich to poor. It's very important that, let's say, a rich person give the wages to a poor person that he's earned and not try to withhold that from him. You know, in Old Testament times, people were supposed to leave the farmers were supposed to leave the corners of their fields unharvested so that poor people could come in and glean. And, you know, by working, they could get their food, and they could even get enough to sell some in the marketplace and start putting aside some money. So, or similarly, when you took fruit from trees, you weren't supposed to take fruit from all the branches. You're supposed to leave it on the high branches. And again, people were willing to work to climb up and get the fruit. I mean, they could be fed in that way, and then also start building some capital for themselves. But there was always the sense of making of justice was providing opportunity. It wasn't, however, treating a person as an animal, as a pet, and just putting some food in his bowl.
You mentioned a key word in our culture today, unfortunately, in our political system today, is the idea of the redistribution of wealth. Your book was used tremendously. I believe it was when Newt Gingrich and GOP Whig had come to Congress, and all the congressmen had been given one of the copies of your book. It resulted in a change in welfare system. I don't know where that's at today, the change, and how that's continuing, but I wanted to ask you if you would comment on what we see taking place today. You know, this massive redistribution of wealth seems to be the prism or the system that is being worked right now, the political system that's being worked in this current administration.
Yeah, it's something that goes against what we've learned in American history. America has become a great country because of our biblical base, and because there was always opportunity. And if you say to someone who has worked hard, I'm going to take it from you and give it to someone who may not have worked as hard, then you're going against the whole pattern of challenge that's made America a great country. So, you know, there are people who fall into poverty for situations beyond their control, sometimes through illness, sometimes through disasters of various kinds, and those people need help. But government has shown itself extraordinarily bad at distinguishing between those who really need help and those who are actually whose character is hurt by just enabling them to lie around all day. Government just can't make that distinction, because that's a question of values. Values are very closely tied to religious beliefs, and we don't want the government discriminating on the basis of religious beliefs. That's why churches and civic groups and others have, throughout American history, done a much better job than the government of offering help when it's really useful and withholding help when it'll actually hurt a person. Government just can't do it, and the more we grow government, the worse the situation we're going to be in.
Well, Marvin, we want to thank you for articulating that today. That really gives us a really good summary of what people will find as they get this book, The Tragedy of American Compassion. We've been speaking with Marvin Olasky, who, of course, is the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. Marvin, thank you very much for visiting with us and for speaking with us about this important issue.
Well, you're very welcome. Hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Okay, you too, my friend.
Bye.
Well, that was Marvin Olasky, as I just said, the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. And the book that we've been talking about for the last half an hour or so was a book that he actually wrote quite a few years ago, but Crossway has repackaged this book. It's called The Tragedy of American Compassion. We really just scratched the surface here today. You really need to read all of the historical aspects of this book, the research that Marvin did in order to build the case for how compassion, mercy ministry, was done throughout our history here as a country. Basically, it appears that Marvin had locked himself in the Library of Congress and basically just went through a number of resources there in a research project to find out how compassion was done. How did we deal with people who seemed to need help? You know, how was this done through the church and through the society at that time? And through looking at that, he then compiles here in the book and builds a very strong case for the way that we should do compassion today, not only in our society, but in our church as well. Highly recommend it to you. It's called The Tragedy of American Compassion. It's put out by Crossway. That's www.crossway.org. It'd be, make an excellent Christmas gift for any pastor or any Christian who's looking to look into mercy ministry in a deeper way. Tomorrow on the radio program, I wanted to let you know that my special guest is going to be Dr. Peter Lilback. We'll be talking about his book, The Misconception, The Wall of Misconception. We'll be talking about the struggle for liberty. We'll see you then, tomorrow, on Knowing the Truth.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660. WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.